Our guest during the second hour is a distinguished military historian who also happens to have had a very distinguished military career, General Dave R. Palmer. That was Lieutenant General at peak appointment. U.S. Army retired now, was the superintendent of the of the Academy at West Point for some 5 years. And some of this book bears upon the history of West Point, of course, as will shortly appear.
Well, it sure does. Yes.
We're dealing with George Washington and Benedict Arnold. That's the title of the book, and the subtitle, A Tale of Two Patriots. They were men who had a good deal of mutual regard originally, isn't that so?
Oh, very much so. They were quite a team in the first 3 years of the Revolution, 1775, 76, 77. They were the two celebrities in the war. The British believed, as did the Americans, that Arnold was the best battlefield leader on either side. And Arnold was Washington's go-to man when he wanted someone to go somewhere, do something independently away from headquarters. Mm-hmm. He always turned to Arnold.
We don't know that. We will be reminded of that once again reading this book, and we will talk about that tonight on the program. But generally, if Americans hear the name Benedict Arnold, the great traitor in the Revolution, and they don't know about his very high military accomplishments before he changed sides.
Well, that's right, and that was done on purpose. After his treason, the Continental Congress decreed that his name would be erased from the register. Mm-hmm. Washington wouldn't let anyone put it in orderly books or mention it, so what he did that was really great for America was erased by his treason. He was wounded in the final battle where he led American troops in October of 77, seriously wounded, when he basically won the Battle of Saratoga in upper state New York. If that musket ball that shattered his leg had gone into his heart instead, killing him at that moment, today he'd be one of the great heroes in American history.
Absolutely, yeah. And that was a very important battle.
Oh, it was,
might almost rank with Yorktown as the second most important battle of the Revolution.
Well, Yorktown was the battle that ended it, but yeah. Saratoga was the battle that made it all possible. It was the battle that was key to bringing the French into the war, which then made it possible for us to win.
In my youth, at the beginning of my academic career, I was an assistant professor at Yale. I learned from this book that Benedict Arnold was the bookseller of New Haven.
Yes, he was.
And the apothecary.
Yes, he spent, he made a lot of his living as a young man selling books to Yale students.
Yeah. We think of these military men as fully trained in the military life, but of course, many of them just decided, I'm going to be a soldier.
There was no training except by experience. And Arnold and Washington both just happened to be extraordinary leaders. And Washington did have more experience. He, as a young man, he had fought in the French and Indian War. Benedict Arnold had none. He was a militiaman for a while, learned to carry a musket. But when the war came along, he was there and ready and eager to fight, and turned out to have all of the natural attributes of battlefield command.
So how does he rise from volunteer to the status of general in just a few months?
Well, by his own initiative. He marched his company, he was a captain, marched his company from New Haven to Boston in 75 after the war began. And he found out on the way that the Americans needed artillery. Well, he knew from he was a trader. He traded, I don't mean to, he traded supplies and into Canada. And he knew that at Fort Ticonderoga in way upper state New York, there was a large storage area of cannons of all sorts. And he arranged with the Massachusetts leaders to have himself made a colonel in the Massachusetts militia to go capture all of that. And he went from one step to another. He was very successful in everything he did. Washington, learning what a great leader he was, made him in the fall of 75, just 3 months after the war started, really. He made him a colonel, put him in the Continental Army, put him in charge of an expedition going through the Maine woods to Quebec. And every time he turned his hand at something, he astonished people with what he did. They began to call him the American Hannibal.
He was apparently fearless, and he would wade into a battle with shells and with bullets whizzing by him, his horses would be shot out from under him, but apparently until Saratoga, he was essentially unscratched.
Well, that's almost true. He was wounded in the attack on Quebec on the last day of December in 1775. Neither he nor Washington had any right by odds to expect to have come out of that war alive. Both led in the front. Both had horses shot from under them, people killed around them, musket volleys loosed at point-blank range. Washington was never scratched, and Arnold had those two wounds.
Washington gets off this great line someplace. You will remember where, I don't quite know, but there's nothing so exhilarating as the sound of a bullet
yes.
passing by you, but not touching you.
He was a very young man. He was 21 years old in his first battle.
That's in the French and Indian War.
Commanding the Virginia militia in the French and Indian War. And he wrote to his brother after the battle that it was something charming in the sound of the whistle of the bullet. Well, that could have been just youthful bravado.
Yeah.
It also could have been that what old soldiers know, it is charming to hear the bullet because that means they missed you.
Mm-hmm. You know that.
Oh, I know that, yes.
Anyone who's
been in battle knows that it's the sound of one that didn't hit you is a good sound.
You were very active in the Vietnam War, I guess.
Yes, sir. I was over there two different occasions for a year each.
What was your command?
I went over before we had American troops there as a captain, and split that year as an aide-de-camp to General Westmoreland when I arrived, and then an advisor. We had no American combat troops, an advisor to a Vietnamese unit. And
one of the 17,000.
About that number.
That was the official number. We had 17,000 advisors there before we started shooting.
Yes. And we were in the field with the Vietnamese. I lived with them, much like we're doing now with the Iraqis, putting American troops, leaders, inside their units. I was with a Vietnamese unit. We'd go sometimes a week, 2 weeks, 10 days, never see another American. We lived with them, fought with them as advisors.
The second time around, you were commanding a fighting unit, I guess.
No, the second time, it was toward the end of the war. My two tours were kind of bookends to the war.
Uh-huh.
I got there as it was beginning, and I got there in 71, 72, as we were withdrawing. And I was an advisor that year to the Vietnamese National Military Academy.
Uh-huh. Later on, you take on the command of the 1st Armored Division in Germany.
In Germany.
And that precedes your appointment as the superintendent of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point.
Yes, the division command's a two-star major general command, and from that I went to West Point, which was 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us back to Benedict Arnold in a curious way. I learned from your book that in the old church at West Point, there are plaques for all of the generals of the Revolutionary War. And the last one is the Benedict Arnold plaque, but it's not like the others, of course.
Well, it's very different. If you ever go to West Point, go to the cemetery and go into the old chapel.
Yeah, I've been there, but
oh, have you?
I never noticed this particular feature.
Well, look to the right as you come in the door and you're facing the altar, and on the right is a row of plaques, all the same size, same color, shiny black material, and all of them have only four entries, a name, Nathaniel Greene, for instance, a rank, Major General. And that was the highest rank we had in the Revolution, except for Washington, who was just the Commander-in-Chief. All the other generals were brigadiers or Major Generals. And a date of birth and a date of death. And they all are exactly the same, identical, all along there. Just those four entries, till you come to the final one, way back to your right, up under the choir loft, where it's almost hidden from view. And it has only two entries. It has a rank, Major General, has no name. It has a date of birth. It has no date of death. And the symbolism is there beautifully. Traitors aren't really people. They aren't worthy of a name. And traitors don't die. They just go away.
Also, old traitors never die.
Old traitors never die.
They just fade away.
Yes.
Or they fade from our memory. But, of course, in fact, he's one of the most famous people in the Revolutionary War.
Interestingly enough, he was. He,
by virtue of his betrayal.
Of his betrayal. Not for all the things that he did. But up until that point, up until he was no longer able to take to the field and started his road which led to treason, He was, he and Washington were the two celebrities, use a modern term, they were the two celebrities in that war.
John Adams, who was rather stinting in giving praise, and was rather a sour character at times.
Yes, he was. Though that's acerbic.
Acerbic would be a better word. He was more critical of Washington than he was of Benedict Arnold.
Well, very much so. He was jealous in a strange way of Washington, and he was fated to follow Washington all of his life. He was his vice president, and he followed him in the presidency, and he always felt just a little insecure around Washington. Mm-hmm. Arnold was from New England, from Connecticut, as was Adams, and Adams was a major supporter of Arnold's. He was of Washington's also. But there was always that little bit of, a jealousy would not be quite the right word, but he was just a little piqued that Washington was as famous as he was.
Sure. We are about to pause for some commercials. When we return, we ought to look at some of the major campaigns. Benedict Arnold as a distinguished commanding general in the Revolution, and then, of course, we come inevitably to his betrayal and his... which also involves West Point, as we will hear directly after we pause for these words. And our guest is Lieutenant General Dave R. Palmer, U.S. Army retired, former superintendent of West Point, and author of a number of military histories, the most recent and utterly readable and really quite fascinating, George Washington and Benedict Arnold, A Tale of Two Patriots, that is just published by Regnery and Company. Handsomely produced as well, with some wonderful illustrations.
They did a marvelous job of putting that book together, and it does have the illustrations are first rate. I might just throw out a commercial. You've given me an opportunity. I don't make a penny on the book. I gave all the rights, movie rights, and others to Mount Vernon, so with a clear conscience, I can shamelessly promote the book. Because anytime anyone buys a copy, it makes a visit to Mount Vernon for some American kid that much better.
Wonderful. And it truly is extremely readable, and one learns a great deal from it. Back to the battles. Actually, you suggest that in the beginning, Arnold, in some ways a more successful general than is Washington.
Well, they were operating at different levels. Washington
to be sure.
was the overall commander, whereas... Arnold was the battlefield commander. The relationship between the two men and what they did is very much like World War II in Europe with Eisenhower and George Patton. Eisenhower was the theater commander. Patton was the man who led who he put out to lead in the key battles. So, and the quite a few interesting parallels there. The two, interestingly, never fought at the same time in the same battle. While they were very involved, they were always in different theaters. Washington saw to that. He sent Arnold where he needed a fire put out. Arnold had a great ability to draw in the militia. And at one point in 1777, before Arnold's last campaign, last battle as an American general, the British were having great success invading from Canada south toward Albany. And Washington sent Arnold up there, and then he sent a circular to all the militia units in New England saying, General Arnold is going to be there. Rally to the flag and join General Arnold. So just his name was worth several thousand men.
The way that war was fought is a little bit confusing to one who has paid attention to modern warfare, where you can kind of define fronts and you can follow it all. But this is thrust and parry in different sectors of the whole eastern seaboard, and even inland to some degree. And one doesn't quite understand the way it's all put together.
Well, you've got to remember that America then and America now were worlds apart. The 13 colonies had only as many people living in them entirely as live today on Staten Island. So
that would be how many?
That would be about 3 million.
Isn't that something?
They were in a little arc all the way from Maine, which was a part of Massachusetts then, down to South Carolina, and almost all of them lived near the ocean. The Wild West almost literally began on the beaches. It was a wild country. There were the major rivers had no bridges. You had to ferry as you went across. To get supplies was difficult. Food was difficult. So the armies were small. The British sent over in 1776 that the king decided he was going to put the rebellion down in one campaign. And they sent the largest expeditionary force they had ever sent anywhere up to that time. It was 35,000 soldiers, some of whom went to Canada. And Washington had about 20,000. That was the biggest army he ever led. So the scale was very different than today. And the scene of war was very different. So you have fairly small units that are maneuvering against one another, and they have to work to come into contact. That was one of the reasons Washington was able to persevere when he was so outgunned and outmanned, is that he could slip away, and the British were never able to pin him up, to capture him.
One of his great defeats, which he managed to redeem and not to allow a total collapse of the Continental Army, was on my home territory of Brooklyn.
Yes, yes.
Where I guess Howe was in command of the British.
It was Howe, a general.
And
general
they almost
William
destroy
Howe.
His army, Washington's army.
They very well could have. Howe made a mistake. He had a great advantage. He had Washington backed up on Brooklyn Heights.
Exactly.
And he didn't follow up his success, allowing Washington to get almost his entire army in a foggy night back into Manhattan.
Slips across the East River.
Slipped across the East River.
Yeah.
A great move. That was, I think maybe that was when Washington really began to see what it took to be a general in that war.
Now, what was the significance of Arnold's first great victory, the one at Ticonderoga?
Well, the significance at Ticonderoga in 1775, he and Ethan Allen together seized it in a surprise raid, is it gave the Americans artillery that they didn't have, 60-some-odd really good bronze and metal iron cannons and mortars, and they were able to pull those back in the winter on sleds to Boston. And using those, they were able to force the British to evacuate Boston in the spring of 1776. And at that point, at that moment in April of 1776, the Americans owned the 13 colonies. There was not a red coat anywhere left in America. So they had essentially won their independence on the battlefield, and that was followed in July with the Declaration of Independence. And from that point on, it was defending what they had won. So the British were faced with having to cross the Atlantic in the days with no radios and only sail, wind power, and reconquer the 13 colonies.
And it took a long time to fully defeat them.
It took, they never were able to defeat them. It took a long time for the British to realize they couldn't defeat the Americans and to be battered enough that they gave up and went home.
Yeah, but and we defeated them, to be sure, but only with something that isn't often fully acknowledged or fully remembered, only with a great deal of help from the French.
Oh, if it had not been for the French, the war would have been very different. I mentioned earlier that Arnold was wounded at the Battle of Saratoga. That he personally broke the British lines. At the point where he was wounded, he fell. The lines were rolled up, and because that was broken, the entire British army had to surrender, and because the French, who were looking for an excuse to get back at the British, they saw this as their chance. They had been helping the Americans, but under the table, surreptitiously. Now they came in on the open.
Now we must come to the great betrayal. Arnold, was under a great deal of criticism from Congress and from others who were somehow perhaps even jealous of his achievements. Also, he was brought under court-martial for supposedly filching funds or something
of
that sort.
Well, after his first 3 years of being such a brilliant commander, he was seriously wounded and had he was a man of action, And he had to lay flat on his back for a couple of months with his leg, wounded leg, in a wooden box, immobilized. And he had time to think. And some people say it's you don't want to give a man of action too much time to think. But he had been treated pretty shamelessly, so had shamefully, so had Washington. Criticisms, adversity, people, the other generals that were jealous who wanted to get rid of him, members of the Continental Congress who wanted to get rid of both of them. And he had used a lot of his money. He was probably the wealthiest man in Connecticut when the war started. His business, of course, trading, disappeared. And he spent his fortune on buying supplies for his unit, food, clothing, guns, artillery for his men, and didn't get paid back for that. And he didn't.
So he had a legitimate complaint.
He had very legitimate complaints. So did Washington. And he said, if they're going to treat me that way, then I'm going to use my rank and my authority and my position to make money. So he starts off knowing he's not going to go to the field again, having made the decision that he's going to start restoring his fortune. And that's the first step down a long path. He started doing things when Washington made him the military commander of Philadelphia after the British evacuated. He started doing things that were certainly unethical and led to illegal actions to make money. And he was good at it. He did start making money.
What sorts of schemes did he employ?
Well, he for one thing, he took over all the British supplies that had to be left in Philadelphia and was raking off a percentage for selling those. He gave a ship captain needed a pass to get a load of goods out of Philadelphia to go sell them, and he couldn't get through the American blockade without a pass from the commanding general. Arnold gave him the pass, but he took a rake off. He used government wagons, horses and wagons, to haul supplies, things of that sort.
Sounds rather like modern urban politics.
Well, I couldn't comment on that.
Reminds me a bit of Chicago.
Yeah.
One could draw parallels. How does he wind up at West Point and come to the act of treachery?
Well, he came to the act of any time a man in high position, this is throughout history, reaches high status and then crumbles, falls into fraud, ends up in a traitor or in jail. It's always because of one of three reasons, or maybe a combination of three. Mm-hmm. Power, the person wants power, money, or sex. And in Arnold's case, it was all three.
We come to his wife, Peggy Shippen.
Peggy Shippen.
Yeah.
Arnold's first wife had died in the first year of the Revolution. Arnold was 36 years old when he, and a well-known celebrity, when he went to Philadelphia. Peggy was an 18-year-old, beautiful girl who was a loyalist and had dated British officers when they occupied the town. He married her, and she became his co-conspirator. That wasn't found out until the 1930s when someone digging in the musty old files in England came across the fact that she was a traitor as well and had been given a lifetime pension by the king. But 2 weeks after their marriage, he sent his first treasonous letter, his treasonous contact to the British. She knew how to reach the British commander because she had dated the man who was the aide to the British commander.
Now, where is he at this time?
The commander is in New York City.
Where is Arnold?
Arnold is the military commander of Philadelphia.
Still in Philadelphia?
Yes. And he gets in trouble there with the Philadelphia authorities, more with the Continental Congress.
But by the time he meets Major Andre, who's his basic contact, he's up at West Point.
Well, yes. In his dealings with the British, he doesn't decide to just turn coat. He decides to go over to the British side, but in doing it for money, he holds out till they offer him £20,000, a huge sum in that day and age, and commission as a brigadier general in the British Army. So that's a part of it, avarice. He's going to make money. Then he decides he's not going to just go to their side and make money. He's going to bring the revolution down around his treason. And he finds the one place the British want more than any place else in America, and that's the fortifications at West Point. The British believed, and the Americans believed, that control of the Hudson River, if the British had control, they'd win the war, because it's navigable all the way to Albany. And the Americans had no fleet. So if the British controlled Albany and they controlled New York City with their navy, they would control the Hudson River.
We pick up the story right at that point. It becomes terribly fascinating and really ultimately, of course, extremely tragic. And the figure of Major André becomes quite important.
Yes.
We will resume that story and with General Dave R. Palmer directly after an update on the news and a quick round of commercials. And my quite special guest is General Dave R. Palmer. You use Dave as your first name, not David.
Well, it is Dave.
That's the way they christened you,
my,
is it?
Yes, my father was a David, and they didn't want a junior.
I see. Fascinating. Lieutenant General, U.S. Army retired, former commandant of West Point, author of a number of important military histories, and the current one, which is utterly fascinating reading. I've enjoyed it tremendously. George Washington and Benedict Arnold, A Tale of Two Patriots, published by Regnery. I should add that you are doing an event tomorrow at the Pritzker Military Library.
Tomorrow evening at Pritzker, yes.
At 5:30 p.m., as I see.
Yes, it is.
That's on at 610 North Fairbanks Court, a very important institution, founded in this town just about 4 or 5 years ago, I think. Now then, we come to the payoff moment, so to speak.
Well, we left with my saying that the Hudson River was the strategic locality in the war. If the British could have gotten it, they believed they'd win the war, and so did the Americans, because the Americans couldn't cross the river with the British Navy there. The only place where the Americans, without a Navy, could stop the British from taking that river was at where West Point is today. It was the fortification. The mountains cross the river at a right angle, and the river has to make two right-angle turns, and it's very narrow.
And they're trapped there, and you can bomb the hell out of them.
Exactly. Yeah. And they fortified it on either side, and the mountains were so rough, in that day and age, ground troops couldn't get into their rear.
Mm-hmm.
So the British were never able to take West Point, which they wanted every single year of the war. So Benedict Arnold, knowing how they want it, bargains with them. I'll get myself made the commander of West Point, he said, and then I will surrender it to you. I'll give you the key to it, and you just walk right in. And that was what his treason would have been. Now, all of this is true. All of this is a history story. If a novelist had written a story the way it really happened, you'd say the guy was demented.
How do you account for it? How could he have been that embittered, since he was a patriot and was a major figure in the Revolutionary War? How could he have become so embittered that he was willing to cast aside all that his public life had meant up to that point?
I think very, very simply and very straight, he was a narcissist.
Uh-huh.
He was ego-centered. To him, the world revolved around himself. And if there was something that was wanted by a higher cause and he agreed with it, he was unbeatable. But if he disagreed with it or it didn't seem to fit what he wanted, he couldn't accept it. He crumbled.
They almost pulled it off, didn't they? It
came very close.
Yeah.
And that's when I was saying if a novelist had written it or if a movie producer had made it, it would almost have the ring of fiction unbelievable.
Let's bring the British Major André into the picture.
The British, they're ready to take West Point. They've got their troops on the ships. The ships are ready. They have one last connection to make, and some British officer has to come up the river and talk personally to Arnold. That was difficult to do, but Arnold figured out a way to meet with André, who was the adjutant general for the British commander, Sir William Howe. He had also dated Peggy Arnold, Arnold's now new young wife, when he had been in Philadelphia. Major André does come up the river. He and Arnold meet, and through sheer happenstance, an incident occurs which causes the British ship to have to pull anchor and drop down the river. So André's forced to go back overland, and he's caught by three American soldiers going back. They realize what they've got when they find the plans to West Point in his boots. And Washington, again, by just coincidence, is on his way to West Point to visit Arnold to tour the fortress.
If Andre had not been apprehended, is it likely that the British could have taken West Point?
Oh, very yes. Yes, they certainly could have. With the commander, the man who knows and can tell everyone to lay down their arms, they could have.
And if they had succeeded in taking West Point, if his betrayal, Arnold's betrayal, had been successful, would that have possibly lost us the Revolutionary War?
Well, possibly, yes. That's a good word. Who can say what would have happened? However, the British thought if they could take West Point, they'd win it. George Washington thought from the very outset the same thing. So they both agreed that West Point, it was called the key to the continent. Yeah.
So it was, as the commanding general said about Waterloo, it was a damn close-run thing, as Wellington said.
It could have been. It could have been.
Andre is hanged.
Andre is caught, and he's caught. He took off his uniform to get away, and he's caught in civilian clothes. Mm-hmm. And that's with the plans of West Point in his boots. That's the definition of a spy. And the penalty for a spy in that war was to be hanged. And Washington wouldn't relent. The Americans, Alexander Hamilton and others, really liked Andre. He was a likable chap. And they thought that it was not his fault that he shouldn't be hanged. Washington would have let him go if the British commander had given him Arnold back, but the British commander couldn't do it. Arnold had escaped and had joined the British, so Andre was hanged.
And Arnold takes on the British commission as a brigadier general, and he's got one last battle in him, this time against the Continental Army.
Yes, as a matter of fact, he led troops, British troops, German troops, and American Loyalist troops, against Americans in two campaigns. Into Virginia. He's the one who chased Thomas Jefferson out of Richmond and back into the hills.
Yeah.
And then his second one into New London, Connecticut, his home area.
Where he takes a wound, I think, doesn't he?
No, he was not wounded. He was not wounded there. He burned the town and ever since is hated in New London, of course.
And shortly thereafter, he repairs to England.
He goes to England toward the end of the war. The war ends. He never returns to America.
He would not be very welcome back in Connecticut.
He would have been killed had he come back. He lived another 22 years in England. Wasn't liked by the British. No one likes a traitor, even if he's your traitor. He tried several business ventures, but things didn't work out. He died a very embittered, broken, an indebted man.
Does Peggy remain loyal to him?
Peggy remained very loyal to him. Mm-hmm. She went with him with her children. He and Peggy are buried, their bones are, in a common grave, just all mingled with others, in a small church in London.
What do we know about Washington's further interest in Arnold or his further reaction to him? There was never any direct correspondence between them from there on, wasn't
it? No correspondence whatsoever. However, Washington ached to get his hands on Arnold. He had a plot to have a sergeant give himself up and switch sides to capture Arnold. That didn't work. When Arnold was in Virginia, he sent Lafayette with a force down to counter him, and his orders to Lafayette were, if you can get your hands on him, execute him summarily. He really wanted that man dead.
But he got away.
He got away.
Yeah. And the next 20 years, he must have lived with great bitterness. I wonder if he had, in fact, self-hate after it was all over. Living those 20 years in exile, knowing that he was the man who betrayed his country?
It's hard to say. He didn't write anything or say anything about it. He just went about his work and trying to start up businesses.
General, if you're ready, let's take a few calls. And here is the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a couple of things. I'm wondering if Saratoga wasn't kind of the last draw for Arnold. I understand he won that battle but didn't get credit for it?
Well, you're quite correct. He was the man who caused it to be won by the Americans. The British commander, in fact, said Arnold was the reason they lost. However, the overall commander, a man named Horatio Gates, took all the credit himself and refused even to really much more than mention that Arnold was there. It's a long story, but you have it right.
Well, I was wondering also, our family is doing our genealogy, and I've run across a major general in the Revolution that you might be familiar with, Alexander McDougall.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. And didn't he take over West Point when Arnold?
He was the commander at West Point a couple of different times.
One of your predecessors, then.
Well, at that time, it was not an academy. It was a fortification.
Yeah.
Yes, Alexander MacDougall, a man who spoke with a Scottish burr.
Well, that's what I understand.
Yes,
and a bit of a stutter, I understand.
He did. He stuttered, and he had a burr. Well, you have a very very famous ancestor.
Yeah, he was really quite a character, and as I'm reading about him, I'm thinking, gosh, he would make a great movie. Well, the reason I say that is he was the very first person in America to be thrown in jail by the British for daring to speak of independence.
Well, I don't know. You may very well be right. He was a radical before the war started.
Ma'am, we thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Well, nice to have heard from you. We are due for a quick round of commercials, then right back to the phones. The excellent book by General Dave R. Palmer is titled George Washington and Benedict Arnold, A Tale of Two Patriots. It is published by Regnery. And we go directly back to the phones.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. Very interesting show. I was wondering if the general would compare General Washington and General Arnold as tacticians during the war, to each other and to their peers, and how each might have used Native Americans in their battle plans?
Well, they operated at different levels. Arnold was only at the operational and tactical level, not at the strategic. Washington was the overall strategic leader. But he did, from time to time, have to come down and lead in battle itself. And in that sense, they were a matched pair. Both were magnificent motivators of men. They were courageous to a fault. They sensed maybe the key point in a battle. They had the ability to mass forces and supply forces, so quite similar. Neither one really used American Indians, Native Americans, much at all. They were generally, as much as they fought with the British against the Americans.
I see. Thank you very much.
We thank you, sir, for the call. Let's go quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I just have a question about maybe Arnold was right. I mean, what would have happened if the British had won the war? Would we have just ended up like Canada? Doesn't seem so bad.
Well, it's impossible to say, of course. But it was not foreordained at all that we would end up the United States of America. We would probably have ended up like Canada in the sense that we would have been perhaps three countries. The New England states might have been one, the Southern states a country, and the Middle states. It very well could have ended up some way like that. I don't think it was in the cards at all that England would have kept this entire continent as a colony.
Here's an interesting comment from via email from a listener. As an Anglophile, Benedict Arnold is my hero. He finally saw the light and switched to the right side. After holding the British up at Valcour Island and then being the key to the victory at Saratoga, what did he get? He was ignored, saw inept generals get praised and promoted, and Congress would not reimburse him for the money he paid his troops from out of his own funds. Who could blame him for turning sides? A listener in Rochester, New York.
Well, and all of that's right. I would only say that George Washington suffered very similar criticism, cabals to get rid of him, political and other generals who were jealous. Both men suffered criticism, setbacks, defeats, adversity. And under all of that adversity, one, Washington grew stronger and stronger and became the father of our country. The other man, under similar adversity, crumbled and grew weaker and weaker and became a man without a country. One had amazing strength of character. The other was empty at the center.
And you end your book with a chapter titled Character.
The last, the whole book is about character,
yeah.
But the first 22 chapters are to hook you to read this fantastic story. Mm-hmm. And the final point is what I just said very briefly to the caller, that the last three words in the book are character is destiny.
Yeah. Richard Brookhiser, as I'm sure you know, did
yes,
a book some years ago about Washington, in which he says that Washington's character was in part a conscious construction that Washington himself undertook.
Washington very much undertook, from when he was a child, when he was a teenager, copying rules of civility.
From that book done by the Jesuits.
Yes.
Yeah.
And all of his life attempting to live as a person of complete integrity, above reproach. He was, he could have quit and gone home to Mount Vernon, but he could never have brought himself to have tried to torpedo the revolution itself.
General, I thank you very much for joining us tonight. You're on a busy schedule, I know, and this has been just a delightful encounter. And I'm happy to recommend the book once again, because I personally enjoyed reading it tremendously. George Washington and Benedict Arnold, A Tale of Two Patriots by General Dave R. Palmer. Published by Regnery.